The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the Vox Markets Podcast. Today is Tuesday, 10th of December, 2019. Justin speaks to United Oil and Gas, ticker UOG, as well as Immu Pharma, ticker IMM. And W Resources, ticker WRES.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Brian Larkin, Chief Executive Officer of United Oil and Gas, UOG's ticker. Brian, welcome back on the podcast. It's been a while.
It has been a while, but we've been very busy, Justin.
I know, it's not a week goes by where I don't get sort of a message from a shareholder saying, get Brian on the podcast. And I think, I understand you're doing a lot behind the scenes, but, you know, there's not a lot of news. You're going to RNS, so we'll have RNS. So it's pretty much pointless, even though I've asked you a couple of times. But it's good to get some news out. So you've finally, you know, talked about this Rockhopper acquisition and the fundraise. We'll get into that in a bit. But as always, Brian, you've not been here for a while. I assume some, hopefully, new podcast listeners have joined, and some may be unfamiliar with what you're about. So please just give a quick summary as to United Oil and Gas, please.
Sure. Well, I'm the CEO of United Oil and Gas. We're a relatively young PLC, listed about 2.5 years ago. And since we listed with one license, we've added 7 more to our portfolio. We've divested an asset. We've drilled 2 successful wells. We'll have one in Italy in production next year. And we've also announced a transformational acquisition of a production business in Egypt, which is Rockhopper's Egyptian business for $16 million. So we're a relatively young company, but we have achieved a lot in the last 2.5 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Lots of prospects and assets. So let's talk about this Rockhopper acquisition in Egypt then. Take us through, you know, all the details if you can, you know, why you've gone for it. There's some other questions as well. I know some from private investors have raised some concerns, so we'll dig into that. But take us through this first, Brian, if you could.
Yeah, sure. Well, if you go back to the beginning of the year, we said to the market, we said to our shareholders that we would go out and do a transformational deal. We said we'd finance it alternatively, and we have delivered that. At the end of the year, we have acquired a production business currently producing 1,100 barrels a day with significant and material, reasonably low risk upside to go and get. In addition to that, we've brought BP in, who have provided a financing debt mechanism to execute the transaction. So it's quite an exciting portfolio of assets that we've purchased. It's a number of producing wells across a number of producing fields. So from a risk perspective, we felt it was hand in glove for us. And it's been a long process. We started looking at these assets just over 9 months ago. And we're very pleased with this morning's announcement that we have completed the financing milestones required to complete the transaction, and now we're really in a process where we look to complete the deal in early January.
Yeah. And in early January, right now, it's producing 1,100 barrels a day, is it?
It is right now. It's producing 1,100 barrels. But if you roll that back to the beginning of the year, the actual net entitlement at the beginning of the year was closer to 800 barrels. So since even we started looking at these assets, production has increased considerably. And that's really based on a pretty aggressive infill drilling program, which the joint venture partners have been pursuing over the last year. And it's also a very important point to note is the effective date of this transaction is actually the 1st of January 2019. So that incremental production is accruing to United Oil and Gas. So from that perspective, it just keeps getting better. In addition, there's a current well being drilled, and we're certainly hopeful that'll produce a positive result for us.
Yeah, well, I saw someone on Twitter saying that these assets, or the question of profitability of these assets. What's the deal here? Why does that come up?
Well, these assets are highly profitable, and I can understand why there might be a bit of confusion, because previously there was an asset in that portfolio, in that pack, that has been impaired. We haven't bought that asset. So you strip that asset out of the portfolio that we have acquired, and this portfolio is actually highly profitable.
Okay. So, yeah, people are getting the wrong end of the stick there and not being accurate on the information.
Yes.
Okay, cool. And some other things today, so something to disgruntled people saying, talking about the share price, you raised at 3 pence. What's your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I can understand that there might be a bit of frustration out there over the placing price, but I think you need to just stand back for a second and look at the market as a whole. I mean, we suspended at 4p in mid-late July. Since then, the market has dropped more than 20%. So if we hadn't suspended at that time, I've no doubt that we would have been placing sub 3p. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, you know, you have to deal with the cards you're dealt with. And there has been, you know, a run of news flow, which hasn't really helped us in terms of disappointing well results across the sector, particularly in the small cap arena. And that worked against us in the last couple of weeks in terms of our placing, because it affects sentiment across the entire, you know, investor pool who invest in micro and small cap oil and gas plays. So I think in taking all of that in context and adding into that political uncertainty and political risk around Brexit and an upcoming election, I think to get this placing away at 6.25 million at 3p is actually a job well done. And I think it's a testament to the assets and to the team and to having BP as part of our financing structure that we were able to get this transaction away. So it's a very good result in what is an almost impossible market to raise capital. So we're pleased, and we look forward to now completing the transaction. And you have to look at the post deal, what, you know, it would be on completion of this transaction. And what we would be an oil company with 1,100 barrels of production, a fairly aggressive drilling program across 2020, one well a quarter, which will generate huge news flow for us. And then look at your existing asset base. We've got Jamaica, which we're moving forward with. We've also got our Crown divestment, which we hope to complete before Christmas. And we've also got activity in the Wessex Basin, along with our other licenses in the Central North Sea. So there's quite a lot of activity, including Italy, of course. We'll have production kicking in from Italy Q3, Q4 next year. So there's quite a lot to be excited about going forward into next year. And that's what we really need to focus on now. It's the next steps for the company and moving forward with it. A transformed business, really, post completion of this deal. I don't think there's a micro cap with a market cap at our level that will be producing 1,100 barrels of oil a day, plus all the upside to chase, which will be funded, more importantly, from free cash flow.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, there's so many things going on. The market has been, do you know what, for as long as I've invested, I find currently it's one of the hardest markets around. Like you say, you've got Brexit, you've got general election, and you've got these quite a few exploration plays in the small cap space that have failed or not worked out. So it's the riskiest end of the market, just exploration. But now you have production, yeah. Now you've got cash flow, and that de-risks you a lot, doesn't it?
Well, exactly. And I can honestly tell you, in the 4 years that I've been CEO of United, it's the worst I've ever seen it. It is extremely difficult to raise capital at the moment. And, you know, you got to look at how business are going to grow in a market where capital is just not available. And I think really what we'll see going into 2020, maybe even into 2021, is a lot of consolidation between microcaps, because it's extremely difficult to raise equity in the current climate. It's a lot of the institutions have raised their barometer, their threshold levels, from what would have been 20 million a year ago to almost 100 million. And a lot of that's driven by a lot of changes in legislation and compliance. So it is quite difficult to raise capital, and it's certainly the hardest that I've seen it. So it really does demonstrate, you know, the success that we've had in raising 6.25 million in an extremely challenging climate.
Yeah, yeah. And to add to this sort of negative sentiment, I mean, we had Tullow, you know, announce their board changes, CEO sort of resigning and all that, and somebody else. CEO and who else was it? And someone else, wasn't it, resigning, I think?
The chief operating officer, that's correct.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that was down 71%. I mean, you have obviously a connection with Tullow, well, with the Jamaican assets. I mean, will that be affected in any way?
Well, Tullow have an obligation to the joint venture partners, and they also have an obligation to the PCJ, which is the subsidiary of the Jamaican Ministry, who manage the licensing. And I expect Tullow, being Tullow and knowing Tullow, they continue to be professional and execute their obligations underneath the existing work programme and to the PCJ and to their joint venture partners. So I don't expect much impact, if any at all. I expect Tullow to continue with the farm down process that we are currently advancing, and that is going well. We certainly hope to have a joint venture partner to move that asset forward with. And that's where we're at. We do expect them to continue to work with us and to work with the JV partnership.
So, like I said, this, you know, majority of this year, or a large part of it, you've been suspended, and like we said, we've seen the market get harder. But what's your thoughts as to, you know, your ambition there at United Oil and Gas? Because you've got an ambitious plan there. Are you still optimistic of fulfilling that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No question in my mind. Absolutely no question in my mind. I mean, if you look at every, like, if you look back over the last couple of years and promises we've made to the market, things we've said we've done, we've absolutely delivered upon that. And I think if you had have said to our shareholders at the beginning of the year in January that by the close of the year we would have a production asset portfolio producing 1,100 barrels a day, generating, which will generate significant cash flow, and more importantly, upside and news flow to go with that. We also would have padded out our executive team by appointing David Quirk as CFO. We would have divested an asset for up to $5 million US that we got essentially for nothing. And I think, and as well, more importantly, added BP as a financing partner to this transaction. And we certainly hope to, and look forward to working with BP into the future. I think all our shareholders would have considered that a fantastic year.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and so looking forward now over the next, say, 3, 6, 12 months, what are you hoping to achieve there, Brian? What's the big sort of milestones, big bits of news you're hoping to tick off there?
Well, there's a lot happening this side of Christmas. In fact, we have a well drilling. We hope to announce the results this side of Christmas on that well in Egypt. Or certainly Rockhopper will be announcing that, and we will be acknowledging it. Into next year, then, you know, we hope to advance Jamaica. We also have Italian production Q3, Q4 next year. We also have wells in Italy, follow-up wells. We have one a quarter for all of next year, so that's four more wells to drill, and that excludes any other M&A activity. More importantly, we'll look at how we create more value from the existing asset base. You know, we'll certainly look at that into Q1 and Q2 next year.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, Brian, it's been a while, but still the same format. And so, you know, if someone's listening to this, likes the sound of what you're doing here, but are not yet following the story, and they see maybe this little dip today as an opportunity, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, just before I give you three reasons, let me just explain why it's been a while. It's been a while because although we've been suspended, I still have to be very careful what I say publicly, because we do have a partner on this transaction who are listed. So we have had to be very careful what we can say publicly, because I would have liked to have said a lot more a lot earlier. Yeah. But now that the suspension is lifted, we can talk a little bit more openly about the deal. But three reasons. Yeah. We've delivered on what we said we'd do this year. We've brought in a new financing partner on this transaction in BP. We will have a production-based business generating 1,100 barrels a day. And we'll have a pretty exciting work program across 2020, which will involve four funded wells to drill in Egypt, coupled with first production from Italy, Q3, Q4, and also advancing our Jamaican project. So there's probably a lot more than three there, Justin, but there's a lot will happen in 2020, and we'll continue to work as hard as we've done in 2019, and hopefully we'll see that reflected in the share price.
Marvellous stuff. Brian, good to chat to you as always. And hopefully, like I say, lots of news flow coming. Hopefully we'll be chatting again in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Pleasure, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
Joining me on the podcast right now is Dr. Navid Malik, Executive Director and Head of Research at the Life Sciences Division, who works with IMI Pharma. Firstly, Dr. Navid, can you give us a quick summary of the Life Sciences Division? And how long have you been following IMI Pharma, please?
Yes, that's great. Thanks, Justin. So basically, the Life Sciences Division is a UK investment bank. We have a number of public market private clients. We work across the UK and European sector in life sciences. I'm an executive director and head of life sciences research. We produce very high quality, detailed institutional research for our clients. We also act as financial advisor and broker to a number of companies. In terms of IMI Pharma, I've known the company since 2010. In the previous investment banks where I built healthcare franchises up, I've been the house analyst and broker to the company. And therefore, followed the drug very closely in terms of Lupuzol, so know it very well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, following the recent announcement by IMI Pharma of its licensing agreement with Avion for its lead compound, Lupuzol, can you provide a summary on your take on this, please, Dr. Navid?
Yes, that would be great. Yes, so Avion is a specialty pharmaceutical business in the US. They focus in a number of areas, including women's health and dermatology, which interestingly mirror quite closely with the type of patient group that ImmuPharma will be presented with in lupus. They are looking to fund the entire US and European clinical trial, the second phase three trial that ImmuPharma needs to do a regulatory filing. What's great about this deal is, in addition to the milestone payments, which total, including the amount invested behind the phase three trial, about $100 million, they are also pledging a 17% royalty. We've therefore been able to model that into our discounted cash flow model. But I think that the great aspect to this deal is that Avion will fully fund both the US and European clinical trial, which means that ImmuPharma is unencumbered in terms of being able to go out and do another licensing deal for the European territory, which is now fully funded to market.
Yeah, I was going to say, they've done that in the US, that deal agreement in the US. And so are you quite confident they can get this in other territories with European partners, etc.?
Absolutely, yes. The reason I'm confident, Justin, is because in this sector, you often want a specialist industrial partner to put their name to the drug, to put their money into the program to develop it clinically. Mm-hmm. And it's a form of validation. So the pharmaceutical sector, as much as it's historically had a lot of turbulence in terms of productivity and generic competition, it's absolutely desperate for new products. And if one company takes the lead, it's often very likely that other companies will continue perhaps the discussions they're having with ImmuPharma. I'm sure there were a number of parties at the table. But more importantly, it's like a catalyst to bring other players more seriously to the table to execute a deal. And what's great about this deal with Avion is because the European market is fully funded now to get the program to market, we have a situation where any particular partner that ImmuPharma signs up actually doesn't have to spend any money on any clinical development for Lupazor. All they've got to do is basically sort of wait for the trial to finish and get on and market it. So ImmuPharma could benefit from a deal where they get an upfront payment and a nice royalty stream, which might mirror what they did with Avion or be even better.
Yeah. Now, you've increased your recommendation from 76 pence to 100 pence, £1, continuing your buy recommendation. Could you provide a little more detail as to why you've increased the target price, please, David?
Yes, that's absolutely fine. So, Justin, as I said, you know, I've known the company for a long time and looked at Lupazor in great detail over the years and written on it many times. So when we did this discounted cash flow model, you know, I had the ability to model what I thought was achievable with the drug with a degree of accuracy, just from my knowledge of the sector, knowledge of the program, and also the lupus space, which I've looked at not just because of ImmuPharma. I used to cover GlaxoSmithKline, so I also looked at lupus through the lens of Ben Lister. Now, because of that, this particular deal that's been struck meant that I could actually now put some, you know, flesh on the bone in terms of the model. By that I mean I had a model which I could produce a set of forecasts from and estimates, but now I have a much more intrinsic ability to hard code in the type of numbers I'm assuming will be achieved with this deal. So I got greater confidence with when the product will get to market in the US and in Europe. I have a good guide on the royalty stream and the milestone payments. And I have also, independently, Avion as this pharmaceutical partner, who've done a high degree of due diligence, who basically validated the confidence that we had at Life Sciences Division around the program. And when you net all of that out and then you reduce your risk rate in terms of your discounted cash flow model, because now we've got a deal and a partner, when we've got greater certainty with the product getting to market, even from a competitive perspective, that's given me the ability to raise the price target from 76 to 100 pence. And also, I've actually increased my confidence of where the product revenues will be in the US. Previously, we had peak revenues around $750 million. We now have revenues above $1 billion.
Excellent stuff. Okay, I see. And so what, in your view, then, differentiates Lupazor to other drugs in this, you know, therapeutic disease area of lupus, then, Dr. Nevis?
So if you think about the type of patient profile we have with lupus, these patients often have a kind of cocktail of different drugs. Those drugs can be inherently toxic because of the side effects, particularly around steroids. What's great about Lupazor is that it's targeting a particular immune cell player called a T cell, ultimately. And what the drug is doing is it's not trying to kind of hit and hammer on an egg to stop the T cell from functioning. What it's doing is it's trying to gently kind of coach the T cell not to attack the patient's own tumor, the patient's own tissue. And as a result, compared to the other drug in the market, Benlysta, which targets B cells, and other players which are coming to the market with AstraZeneca, for example, with a drug which targets interferon receptors, those particular approaches tend to have a more aggressive approach, which is fully reflected in the side effect profile that's emerging with these drugs. Whereas ImmuPharma has not only potential to develop great efficacy in controlling the lupus patients and slowing the disease down and giving them real improvements clinically and symptomatically, but also it has a really excellent safety profile. And when you put those two things together, you end up with what they call a wide therapeutic window, which means that doctors will have more confidence in giving Lupazor to a lupus patient than potentially with the other players out there in the market.
I see. And can you give a view on milestones, ImmuPharma or news flow ImmuPharma hoping to achieve or get out to the market in the next, say, 3, 6, 12 months?
Yes, that's, again, a very good question because, you know, the first thing investors do is they look at a deal headline value and then they kind of take a breather and they're not sure what may happen next. For us, it's very clear for me as an analyst following the stock, basically, there are going to be a sequence of announcements and news flows generated in 2020 around the clinical trial for the second phase 3 with Lupazor starting. There'll be joint announcements with Anveon and ImmuPharma. So ImmuPharma's profile in the US is going to be raised significantly as a result. More importantly, as I mentioned earlier, there's a good chance that we'll see further partnering deals. I mean, ImmuPharma isn't necessarily in a rush to do them, but I think the market is in a rush to see good products get to the market for patients. So it's possible we may see further deal flow. But as importantly, ImmuPharma is not a one-trick pony, so to speak. It's not a one-product company. It has other programs and other pipeline assets. We like Nucan, which is an oncology program. It has good potential to be very novel in the oncology space, and that's a deal that could be done for ImmuPharma. The second asset, which we like as well, is Eureka, which is a peptide enhancing technology. That could be very exciting. It's much earlier stage, it's preclinical, not in patients yet in clinical trials. But there is the possibility that we could see news flow around that program as well. So ImmuPharma's got this fantastic deal now, benchmarked itself in Lupazor with Anveon, and now we have the ability to generate multiple areas of news flow through 2020.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's your view generally, of the sector in 2020, and how will this, benefit specifically ImmuPharma?
So again, that's a really good question. You know, if you think about 2019, at the beginning of the year, I was quite confident because I could see a number of late stage companies with phase 3 assets coming through fruition in terms of going through clinical development successfully, either as therapeutics or diagnostics. So the sector looked pretty healthy. However, during the course of the year, we've had obviously ongoing issues with Brexit, and we've had some turbulence in the institutional market surrounding some investors who have been big players in biotech who've now, had challenges. That has meant that a lot of capital has dried up for the sector. The net result of those two aspects is that the sector was driven down in terms of valuation. Investors saw greater risk in the sector emerging. And because of that, we've had the unusual situation of a number of companies that I follow, or previously I've been the analyst for, or where we're actually advisor for, who've gone through successfully in clinical trials. In some cases, they've done 2 clinical trials successfully, and yet their valuations are nowhere near what they should be. In fact, the valuations are all showing or signaling that they're priced to failure. They're not priced to success. And it's simply a peripheral issue in the UK. So I think the UK biotech sector is due for a significant bounce as these risks appear to be overplayed, and as these companies move towards actually generating revenues and having successful approvals in the market and further partnering deals. And you could put all of those aspects on ImmuPharma as a kind of, a haze and say the clouds are clearing, we're starting to see a lot more clarity. And so from IMI Pharma's perspective, and also from a re-rating in the sector perspective in life sciences and biotech in the UK, I can see a strong upward momentum in the course of the next 12 months.
Excellent stuff. Well, Dr. Navid, thanks very much for that. Now, hopefully we can catch up again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks a lot.
Pleasure. Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Michael Masterman, chairman of W Resources, WRES. His ticker there. Michael, thanks for joining me.
Justin, great to be on Vox.
Yeah, and last week you're moving this company along here nicely. Another finance update, and we'll dig into that as to what it's all about. But as always, if someone's just dipping into this and hearing W Resources for the first time, just summarise the business for them, if you would, Michael.
Okay, so W Resources is focused on tungsten, tin and gold in Spain and Portugal. Our largest asset, La Perilla, is a large tungsten tin mine. We've built the mine, we've built the plant, we're producing tungsten, and we're taking it forward into large-scale production and cash flow.
Yeah, absolutely. And just talk about those predicted forecasted cash flows, hopefully what you're going to hope to generate there and you know, in the next few years.
Okay, so La Perilla will produce 2,700 tons of tungsten concentrate and also tin. That will translate at our line of sight operating cost structure into $20 million per annum of cash flow. And we have a expansion plan that will take it up to $40 million of cash flow. Those cash flows are pretty much equal to our current market capitalization.
Yeah, yeah, and that is. There's not many companies that can say that. You know, when you ramp up and get up to that production, currently you are valued at what, 20 million sterling, of course.
Yeah.
So that's quite an impressive return there. Okay, so let's get into this.
And it's not as if this is something that might happen in the future. Yeah. We are producing tungsten and tin as we speak from a large-scale, low-cost plant that has a mine life of currently 11 years and will extend to 15 or 20 with some pretty sensible extension drilling.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Marvelous stuff. And take us through this finance update. What's this all about, Megan?
Well, I think if you stand back, what the company is able to do, and this is, again, reflects a Spanish insider perspective on where we're going, is we've now got large Spanish banks and large Spanish investors realizing that we're moving into large-scale cash flow and they're willing to lend to us. We just did a bank facility with CaixaBank, which is one of the largest banks in Spain, to provide us with low-cost debt finance. And we've also been able to issue equity at a premium to the market price. So we're getting very strong support from Spanish banks with low interest rate loans, and we're getting strong support from Spanish family office investors, which is a credit to where we are and a credit to where we're going.
It's almost suggesting here that professionals here, the people loaning money, can see the value here, and hence the loaning and the fundraising. But yet the market hasn't caught up with it yet.
Yeah, no, the market hasn't caught up to it yet. The UK market and the AIM market's had its distractions. Hopefully one distraction will be out of the way on the 12th of December. In the new year, we're incredibly well positioned for a major re-rating.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know what? That's the issue. I think there's a lot of things, money sitting on the sidelines. I mean, investment is in paralysis here at the moment because we've got this Brexit and general election, and hopefully we'll move ahead in one way or another, come the new year. But yeah, that's the issue, I think. And I genuinely think there's a re-rate on the cards for many a company. A lot of companies across stock markets in the UK, if we get some line of sight, to a deal somewhere here, and that's the issue, holding everyone back, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's not many days, the UK election, and just some certainty, some stabilization of the equity market. The general equity market outlook is going to do wonders for small cap stocks like us. Mm-hmm. And we're a small cap stock, but a small cap stock that has a very large mine and plant producing tungsten. Lots of scope to grow, and investors should take a very, very close look at W Resources.
Marvellous stuff. Thanks for that, Michael. And just quickly, if you need to remind them any more, give them three reasons, because I think you're a bit of a shareholder as well, aren't you?
I'm the largest shareholder. Yeah. So three reasons. One, La Perilla Mine and Processing Plant is construction's completed, the plant's commissioned, we're producing tungsten, and you're going to see a very rapid ramp up in the amount of tungsten production over the next 4 to 6 months. That's going to translate into significant earnings. Our projected EBITDA in 2020 is of the order of $20 million, and that will expand as we move into the expansion. So you've got a company with a low market cap, large prospective earnings, sitting ready for a significant re-rating.
Marvellous stuff. Good to chat to you, Michael. Happy Christmas, and hopefully we'll catch up in the new year. Thanks very much.
Have a great break, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And the most followed companies on Vox Markets today are, starting with number 5, Deep Matter, ticker DMTR. The fourth most followed company is Oracle Power, ticker ORCP. The third most followed company is Parity Group, ticker PTY. The second most followed company today is AsiaMet Resources, ticker ARS. And the most followed company on Vox Markets is Tullo Oil, ticker TLW. And the five most liked RNSs today, at number 5, there's Emotion Group, where they've appointed a new chairman, who's a former Sony managing director. And the fourth most liked RNS comes from Horizonte Minerals. Their CFO has bought shares. And the third most liked RNS today comes from Rheobold Resources. They've started drilling at VG6. The second most liked RNS today comes from Emerson, where their Chemisit project is now eligible for government subsidies. And the most liked RNS comes from AsiaMet Resources, where they provided a company update.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.